This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most Americans have become increasingly frustrated with government. They're done with gridlock and shutdowns, partisan bickering, and just the general way things get done or don't get done in Washington. But all politics is local, and local politics is where citizens have the potential for the greatest impact on their elected officials. And yet, how many of us have ever attended a city or county council meeting? Let me see. I'm going to count now. I'm done. By making the focus of food local, America's slow food movement has begun to have an impact on those of us who eat and on America's industrial food system, resulting in greater awareness of what we eat and how it gets to our table. In the process, the movement has also helped local farmers and the local economy. So perhaps it's time to take a page from the slow food movement and apply it to government. Slow democracy holds the promise of rediscovering community and bringing decision-making back home. At least that's what Susan Clark asserts in her book, Slow Democracy. She says that slow democracy can make local government more relevant and inclusive, and she joins us for the hour to talk about that. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And in addition to being a writer, Susan is an award-winning radio commentator and former talk show co-host, and is also the co-author of another book on town meetings and community. She serves as town moderator of Middlesex, Vermont, and that's where she is this morning in advance of an impending visit to Salisbury, because in our studio is the woman who invited Susan Clark here to speak on the issue. Maggie Blackwell is mayor pro tem of the city of Charlotte. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Sorry for the weather this morning. Nice to have you fight the weather and get down here today. Where did the idea for slow democracy come from, Susan? Where did it originate and why? And did you coin the term?
As far as I know, I did. Yes. I was out in the garden, actually. It's sort of that got that slow food connection. And I was thinking about the work that I do with communities. And it struck me that it was there's a parallel there to the slow food movement. And it was kind of funny because I came inside. I was really excited. I said to my husband, yeah, slow democracy. I really think, you know, we need to write a book. And he said, hey, you know, great idea. You could even get the domain name, slowdemocracy.org. And then I realized he was teasing me because he said, yeah, while you're at it, why not see if you can get paintfuldentistry.org too? the joke, of course, who wants their democracy to be more slow, right? But you have it right. We're thinking along the lines of the slow food movement, meaning, you know, the people who argue that fast food is sort of a symbol of what's wrong with the world today, we've become so in love with centralization and we've sort of overprocessed the meaning out of our lives. So I think you get the idea. Slow democracy, it's not a call for longer meetings or more time between decisions.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with time. But then fast food has nothing to do with speed either, at least recently.
When you think about the length of time between the cow and the burger, yikes.
Yeah. Frank Bryan, who is a professor of political science at the University of Vermont, wrote the foreword to your book. And in that foreword, he says, it is the blueprint for a redemption of American democracy, which he also says is nearly brain dead. It now gasps for air, its parts panting along, but its heart beating even fainter. Wow, are things really that serious?
Yikes.
Yeah.
That's scary stuff.
Well, it is scary stuff. But if you look at some of the numbers, you know, I think it was in 2011 that Congress had a 9% approval rating. Mm-hmm. And you think, oh my gosh, can it get any worse? Well, you know, during the government shutdown, the Congress dipped to, I think, an all-time low of 5% approval rating. So, which is lower than Castro's in America in terms of approval rating. So we really have to think about what our democracy means to us. And this is where we start thinking about, you know, democracy. Can we really look at our government and think of it as a we and not a they? What are some of the elements that can make us re-own our government?
You know, when you talk about democracy and our government, I'll bet most people immediately think of the word Washington. Since you're on the town council and you're the mayor pro tem of the city of Salisbury, when you think of government, do you think of Washington or do you think of Salisbury?
Of course, I think of Salisbury, but more specifically, I think of our citizens because we have 14 boards and commissions in Salisbury, and they tell us what they want us to do. So more specifically, I actually think of the citizen level rather than our big dais and City Hall.
And really, it is – local government is where the rubber meets the road. It impacts more people than the federal government, really, when you come right down to it. And you have more you're more liable to be able to actually interact with the people who are in that you've elected to government and make a difference. Am I right or wrong with that?
It affects you more in your daily life, I think. The pothole in your road, the your access to broadband in Salisbury, all those things.
And yet, it's known that most people cannot name their congressperson. Can they name their city council person, do you think?
The people I know do, but I don't – well, I'll tell you. This summer, there was a party in a public housing area, and I tried to make all the parties that evening. They were all around the city, and I got to the public housing area towards the end, and they had already shut down, and I walked up to a stoop where two ladies were sitting, and one of them said – "You're Maggie Blackwell. You're the mayor pro tem."
Wow. Hey,
and I said, "How'd you know that?" She said, "I read my Salisbury Post." So, yeah, I think we underestimate our citizens a lot of times.
Frank Bryan, getting back to Frank Bryan, who wrote the foreword to your book, Susan, he says something else that's kind of been talked about in the media, that the center in American politics is collapsing. And he says that your solution, slow democracy, this face-to-face democracy, and governing the place ourselves will give the center space to breathe again. I'm sure that you agree with that statement because it's in the foreword to your book, but I'm not sure that I understand it. What does it mean?
Well, excuse me. Yeah, I think that it's very important to remember that we see so much polarization in the media. We see these talking heads or screaming heads on TV, and think that this is the way America is. We're an ideological country that is polarized. But we have some really compelling research that we found that we put in our book that really points out that. That's actually sort of a figment of the imagination of the polarizing elements in our government or in the parties or in the media that are basically looking either for good media. It's always interesting. A fight is always interesting, or they'd rather see us polarized. Some of the partisan groups would like to see us polarized because it makes us more engaged. But on most issues, Americans, it's really interesting to look at the actual data and see that we agree on much, much more than we disagree on. And if we can see our way clear to recognize not only each other as partners in this, but the government as our tool to get things done, we will be able to move forward on those things we agree on.
So are you also saying that becoming more involved at the local level, whether it's attending a city council meeting or serving on a commission or at least sending an email to your city council person, letting your feelings be known about something, that the center will begin to emerge and they won't have to play to the left and right bases of their particular parties?
That's right. I really do think, and slow democracy, I would say, is neither liberal nor conservative. And in fact, I think it's you could argue whether this book should even be in the political science department. It's not about politics. It's about what we believe in and how we can move forward together. That's absolutely what I'm saying.
I know that slow democracy calls for an understanding of local issues and process and policy, just as the slow food movement encourages people to understand how food moves through the chain and gets to their table, and that greater understanding of that has led people to say, well, I need to support my local farmers. I'll eat better. It won't be as processed. I'll go to the local farmer's market and buy my tomatoes. I won't go to the grocery store and do that because they came from Mexico. And it makes you healthier and makes you understand how the food system works. But critics of slow food have said that that works great on a micro level, but you can't feed the country that way. You can't feed the world that way. So can slow democracy work outside of local government, local markets?
Right. it's a great question. And I think that we need to start thinking about change very differently. In fact, we already, interestingly, already are thinking of change differently when we think about our internet usage and our internet connection. We've really started to change as a society, maybe as a species. When we think of change as being this sort of top-down process, you know, a leader comes up with an idea and brings people along. But in fact, now the way we're communicating and the way we're making change is more like a wiki, more like a bottom-up process where millions of people come together in their own communities and whether that's a physical community or an online community, and change trickles from the bottom up. It's called emergent change. That's the sort of the way... if you think about a school of fish, and who's the leader of the school of fish? Well, there isn't one. Or a flock of starlings making that beautiful pattern through the air. There's no leader, but they're not bumping into each other. Mm. It has to do with the science of groups and the way that we can move together. This is the kind of change we're seeing. Lots of small changes at the local level creating global patterns.
Now, you're coming at all of this from the point of view of somebody who is a facilitator on community issues, that you focus on community sustainability and citizen participation. And as someone involved in community development work, you're also the town moderator of, I guess Montpelier, is that right? Montpelier, Vermont?
Middlesex, Vermont.
Middlesex,
right outside,
me.
Right outside Montpelier, yeah.
So you get it. Why do you think others don't? Why do you think so many people are not engaged, at least at the local level, where you're fixing potholes and you're deciding where a sewer line's going to run and where a shopping center's going to be?
Right. Well, we've seen a very interesting change over the last few hundred years here in America. When you think about the 1700s and 1800s, when Alexis de Tocqueville came to visit America and was so astonished by how much public engagement and citizen deliberation and debate there was here compared to Europe, we were started as a nation of can-do people who were working at the local level, really for revolution. What happened, a number of things, but one of them was the Industrial Revolution that really changed the way we think about how to get change done. There's a very hierarchical element to the Industrial Revolution and a real reliance on experts. How are you going to fix this gigantic machine? Well, we need to bring in the expert. Things have changed a lot since the Industrial Revolution, and frankly, it's over. we need to move on with our metaphors. Because that Industrial Revolution mindset really permeated our government, yeah. And other elements.
I want to come back to that because I think that's really very, very interesting. It's something I never thought about before. But I want to know, given the fact that we are where we are today and so few people do participate locally in their government, why did the two of you? What was the kicking off point for you to get involved? Maggie Blackwell, you're the mayor pro tem. And, I look at people who serve on city councils and county commissions and think, gosh, I feel sorry for them. Because you have to deal with reams of stuff that is not exactly scintillating reading and come up with policy that is really, really difficult sometimes to get your head around. So when we come back from the break, I want to find out about what it is about all of that that made you and you, Susan, want to get involved. We're talking about slow democracy. We're going to come back and get the answers to those questions and more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Catawba College in Salisbury, offering the opportunity to design a major, an education rich in personal attention, blending liberal arts with career preparation. Details at catawba.edu. And the King's Kitchen restaurant in Uptown that donates 100% of its profits to feed the poor, now open for breakfast that includes a complimentary cup of coffee through March 18th. KingsKitchen.org. NFL Hall of Famer Joe DeLamalur lives in Charlotte, but he spent years butting heads with some of the fiercest players in the league. The same thing that earned him a place in the Hall of Fame also earned him a lifetime of aches and pains and now a diagnosis of degenerative brain disease. He's been on the forefront of getting the NFL to do something about brain injuries for former players, and we'll talk about that and more with him Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The CBO says a minimum wage hike would boost incomes but cost jobs. Workers at Tennessee car plant vote against joining the UAW, and a Nebraska judge strikes down a state law allowing the Keystone XL pipeline.
The News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about slow democracy, which is actually an old philosophy with a new brand, essentially, about getting involved at the local level and letting American politics, the center of American politics, reemerge. Susan Clark is the author of the book, Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back Home. She joins us from Vermont. And in our studio here, Maggie Blackwell, Mayor Pro Tem of the City of Salisbury, who is responsible, I think, for bringing Susan Clark to town, which we'll talk about in a second. But getting back to the question that I asked just prior to the break, why did you get involved?
In city government?
Yeah.
About 10 years ago, I was neighborhood president in my small historic neighborhood in Salisbury.
And why did you get involved in that?
Nature abhors a vacuum. Yeah, our neighborhood organization had been in existence for a long time, and like a lot of organizations, it had ups and downs, and it needed a shot in the arm. Mm-hmm. So I stepped forward.
But other people would not have, and didn't.
Oh, well, yeah, I can't answer that.
Okay.
I don't know why. But we had a high – it's a historic neighborhood. It's over 100 years old. High concentration of houses with 90-plus-year-old citizens in them. And as I walked around the neighborhood, I began to think ahead in 10 years, what's going to happen to these houses? These people go to nursing homes or and so on. So I have a choice. Do I want landlords to buy these houses? Or do I want young families to buy them and improve them? How do I attract young families and not landlords? We need a park in our neighborhood. And this evolved over many walks through the neighborhood. And I began to look around for areas that would make a park in our already built neighborhood. Turned out we had one, exactly an acre, small pocket park size. And I went home and looked it up on GIS, and the city of Salisbury owned half of it, and a private citizen owned the other half, and there was a creek down the middle. It's just perfect for kids to play in. So I contacted my councilman, and long story short, we built a public-private partnership. Our neighborhood raised over $45,000 to build the park, and then we ceded it to the city for them to maintain it in perpetuity.
But, you know, that's a lot of work. And your job as mayor pro tem and being on the city council is a lot of work. And you are the town moderator, Susan, up in Middlesex, Vermont. A lot of work. Again, you know, you don't need this. You're not going to get rich doing this. So why?
Well, listen to you. You're asking me. Imagine if here I was with my child and you said, oh, you have a fine, upstanding looking son. But, man, that must have been a lot of diapers. You know,
yeah, well, that would be my response.
And wow, that must be expensive. And now you have to save for college. Why do people have children? Why would they even, you know, and of course that is, you know, some people do think of it that way and some people know those things and yet move forward anyway because of the rich rewards. And so, you know, maybe we should advertise kids as a lot of diapers and a lot of college money, keep the population down. But we do advertise getting involved in government that way. Think about the way you get involved to a public, invited to a public hearing. We put maybe a, you know, a white piece of paper with a little bit of black ink on a telephone pole, you know, saying, you know, public hearing, 7 o'clock, uncomfortable chairs.
face the triumvirate.
That's the party invitation. That's the way we hope somehow to get people involved. You know, it's like advertising their dirty diapers of parenting. When, in fact, that story that Maggie just told, what a wonderful story of, you know, going home, Googling it. Wait a second. I see a solution here. I see flowers. I see a park. I see happy children running around. You know, that was her idea of what government means.
I have to ask you, what is a town moderator?
Well, it's a funny thing. When we say town meeting here in New England, we mean something different from every other region of the country. We are actually the only part of the country that has a real town meeting, which is something that we've been doing for 300 years, carried over part of it with some of the English government, actually. But it's a at once a year, our citizens get together in our towns, and we are actually the legislative branch of the local government in our towns here in Vermont and most New England states. So when we have a town meeting, the what we call the select board is the executive branch, and they've proposed a budget. We who show up at the town meeting are actually amending the budget, making suggestions, asking questions, and ultimately are the make the binding decision, yes or no, on that budget.
And so I knew a little bit about New England and their town meetings. And as I was thinking about that yesterday, I thought, well, I wonder if this slow democracy movement works better in New England because of those meetings and the tradition that you have of these towns getting together. And there are a lot of small towns in New England, as opposed to here where we're kind of spread out and we have a lot of small towns, but they don't function the same way that yours do. Is it easier to do it there than it would be to do it elsewhere?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a challenge in a way that we've heard people say, oh, well, slow democracy, that's easy in small places, but what about Chicago or L.A.? And the answer really is about scale. What I see again and again is that citizens are very hungry for this kind of participation. They're looking for structures that will help them, will invite them in. But, for example, in New York City and Chicago, a slow democracy process is emerging, a really exciting one, at the ward and district level, and it's called participatory budgeting. And a really wonderful mechanism that's actually been approved by the UN as a good governance practice. It's used across the world, just emerging here in the U.S., where it's a lot like a town meeting, actually, at the district or ward level. Anybody who is a voter can come into the process, discuss a piece of the budget. It's the discretionary funding piece, usually around 15 or 20% of the budget. Come up with wild and crazy ideas of how they want to move forward with that money, then actually ultimately make the citizens in that area make binding decisions on that. So it has the three elements that we call slow democracy, which means inclusion, deliberation, and power. So it's very inclusive. Anybody who is a voter can come in and participate. In fact, I think anybody who's a resident. It's deliberative in that it's not just should we do A or B. It's let's co-create C. Let's work together to really envision what we want. And it's empowered, meaning this isn't advisory. When we come up with a solution, we're going to vote on it, and it's going
to
happen.
Of course, it's only inclusive if you come to the meeting. And I have to bring that. That brings me to Maggie here, because she says that one of the characteristics that you have noticed about participation in town meetings in Salisbury, which I'm sure works slightly differently from what Susan just described, but it's been almost all white and middle-aged people. 34 people come to an average meeting. 34 people is 1% of the population of 34,000 in Salisbury. 1%.
It's 0.1%.
Oh, excuse me, 0.1%.
Yeah.
God, I'm math challenged, as you can tell. But this really, is this the case of the squeaky wheel getting all the attention, that if only 0.1% come, participate, make their preferences known, maybe bang on the podium when they get a chance to speak? I mean...
Well, and that's exactly why I read Susan's book and emailed her and invited her to come to our annual retreat and talk to us about more innovative ways to include citizens so that we get a broader voice.
I mean, it's pretty shocking, but I'm sure that it is normal for most towns.
Yeah, I think it is. I have attended other municipalities' meetings in our county, and I don't see reams of people at their meetings either.
Why do they come to the New England town meetings? What's the difference?
Well, and I have to say that Maggie's right. I think I hear over and over again this. It's called STP, the STP syndrome. Same 10 people
well,
get involved. I have to say that I think the defining factor of a New England town meeting is power. We know that when we come to a meeting, by the end of that meeting, we'll be making a binding decision that will move forward. It's very difficult, I think, for municipal leaders where it's not part of the structure, to realize that part of getting people to give up some of their precious time to come and help define policy is going to be linked to really giving people a part in that decision. It can't just be only advisory.
Was it always this way, do you think? I mean, if we were having this conversation in 1865 or 1870, take the war out of it, would people have come to the town meetings in Salisbury in more representative numbers?
Excuse me. I think even more recently there was more involvement, maybe in the 1960s and 70s.
Uh-huh.
A lot of things have happened since then. Women have entered the the workplace. People are very consumed with men or co-parenting. So both parties in a marriage are busier than they once were. So people are more absorbed with their home lives, and I think that may be part of it.
Hmm.
I would like to say, though, that decision-making process can be so empowering. A few years ago, Salisbury created a housing commission, which no one ever thought would happen. It took a long time to make that happen. That housing commission brought an ordinance to City Council this week suggesting that we shorten the time for property owners to make repairs to houses if those conditions threatened the health or safety of the occupants. Now, three of our city council members are landlords, and the commission was very worried about bringing this ordinance. Everything used to have 60 days, but now if you don't have heat or you have inadequate sewage facilities or something, you have 48 hours to fix it.
Mm.
And the commission brought it because it was the right thing to do, but they were very worried about it being passed, and it passed unanimously. And this commission that we thought would never be formed brought this very strong law, and it was passed unanimously.
Well, that, it seems to me, addresses one of the issues that might be keeping people away from meetings, and that is a cynicism about government. It doesn't matter what I say, they're going to do whatever they want to do, and the big moneyed interests are going to get their way, developers, whomever, landlords. And what I have to say is they're just going to snicker behind closed doors and do what they're going to do. You've shown them otherwise.
Yeah, so this Tuesday we proved them wrong, and it's up to us to continue to listen and be open-minded and pass things that make good sense for our citizens.
You write in your book, Susan, that despite having spoken all over the country on various topics as a professional, you never felt more validated than when you spoke at your local school board meeting and the board paid attention to your opinion. You write, "My school board doesn't see parents as a they, and you don't see the board as a they. We all know we are in this together." But did they give you credibility because you volunteer a lot, because you do, or because you're just an ordinary citizen who had something to say?
Well, I think relationships are important. I don't think that you get two votes if you volunteer, if you make a lot of cupcakes for the PTO. But you may, you're going to maybe get more eye contact. No, it's not a question of paying those kinds of dues. It's it is a question, though, at the local level of understanding your neighbors. So much of what we call... we call it social capital, and it's a richness. Capital is a good metaphor because it's a richness in a community of interconnections between people. That kind of social capital moves us forward when we have difficulties, when we don't see eye to eye on a question, you know, for example, that Maggie mentioned of landlord relations. When we have the kind of trust and connection built up over the years of, maybe it's working together on an ambulance squad, or maybe it's because it's an agricultural community, and, you know, maybe we have political differences, but we connect in other ways, that can really help us move forward.
That brings me to one of your observations about Salisbury, Maggie, that I'm certainly can be extrapolated out to other municipalities. You have told us that you have 14 boards and commissions with an average nine members each. And if I did the math right, that's 126 people. You need 126 people to be in those citizens, to be in those groups. You have trouble in the town of 34,000 of finding 126 people to serve on those commissions and boards. And it's harder still to find the diversity that you'd like to have on those boards. So how do you convince people that it's worth their time and their effort to serve? And why do you think that they don't think – individual citizens don't think of themselves as citizens who should fill those commissions?
Well, as Susan said, everything is based on relationships. Everything. The success of everything is based on relationships. So if I go to somebody and personally say – I think you would make a great addition to the Greenway Committee because you use it, you walk your dogs on it. I think that you could relate to this and make a real impact. I have success. But if we say on air in City Council or broadcast locally, mm-hmm. please apply, that's very ineffective. So I have to take it back to the personal relationships. I'm in the process now of doing the tour of the Lions Club, the Rotary, and so on to talk to people and try and revive some interest in this service. So that
but the Lions Club and the Rotary are people who are already programmed to serve.
Yeah.
That's why they're in those organizations.
Yeah, that's true.
How do you get the broader public who are not in the Lions and the Kiwanis and the Moose Lodges, how do you get them?
Well, that's what we're waiting to hear Susan tell us on March 18th. Okay. No pressure, Susan.
Yeah,
I'll bring my secret box.
A couple of weeks ago, we had one of the actors who's in a play called The Mountaintop, which is sitting down for the month of February at the Booth Playhouse, and I moderated an after-show discussion last night with the two actors in that play. It's about the last night of Martin Luther King's life. And in that play, they humanize him. He's been taken off his pedestal, and he becomes a human being. And I asked, is there a danger in that? Because we want to see heroes in our lives. And the lead actor said, no. And in fact, we need to see these people as human beings, because if you see them as people on pedestals, it gives you a reason not to act, because you could never do what they did because they're them. Well, in truth, he's just us. Martin Luther King was just an ordinary guy who found himself in a situation and acted. Is that part of it? Convincing people that they are worthy, that they can do this.
Well, I tell you, when I was walking around the neighborhood considering a park, I turned to my girlfriend and said, we really need a park in the neighborhood. And I was fantasizing. In my mind, it needed to happen, but it wouldn't happen because who would know? And she turned to me and said, well, then build one. Mm. And I owe that girlfriend so much because with her simple words, she empowered me. And you know, the park led to a retiring councilman inviting me to run for his spot. So, it changed my life for simple phrase.
I want to mention.
I think both of you are making wonderful, wonderful points. I'm just getting goosebumps here listening to these stories. It's absolutely true.
Susan Clark, who is with us from Vermont, is coming to town, coming to Salisbury, by the way, on the Tuesday, March 18th. She will be the keynote luncheon speaker there for the Salisbury City Council's 29th Annual Future Directions and Goal Setting Conference. And I asked Maggie Blackwell, Mayor Pro Tem, who's with us also, if that's open to the public. And she said, yes, by law, everything we do is open to the public. So now you know, and you can get more information about that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the professional MBA program at USC's Darla Moore School of Business. Convenient location in Uptown Charlotte. Details at moore.sc.edu/PMBA. And Mr. Rogers Windows, a local family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at MrRogersWindows.com. Well, it's Friday. That means it's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, the International Hour at 11. But in the 10 o'clock hour, they'll hit the national stories. The Congressional Budget Office says a minimum wage hike would boost incomes, but cost jobs. Workers at a Tennessee Volkswagen plant vote against joining the United Auto Workers, and a Nebraska judge strikes down a state law allowing the Keystone XL pipeline. Those and other stories to be talked about in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show.
WFAE has a challenge for you. Last fall, you eliminated 4 days of our fundraiser by responding to our request to pledge early. We want to do it again and are encouraging you to pledge early today to help shorten the upcoming spring fund drive. Every dollar brought in before the campaign will go towards the goal of $650,000. And for every $65,000 raised, we'll eliminate a day. Pledge your support at WFAE.org and help shorten our fundraiser. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Susan Clark is the author of Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back Home. She joins us from a studio in Montpelier, Vermont. She is the town moderator of Middlesex, Vermont. Maggie Blackwell is with us. She's the mayor pro tem of the city of Salisbury. She just shared a bunch of pictures with me off the air of people coming to city-sponsored events. And she said, we get all kinds of turnout for all these different events. Except for city council meetings, which is what we're trying to encourage people to do, to get back involved in local government, because that's the whole raison d'etre behind slow democracy. You brought up another example, Maggie, of about a recent project to redesign a couple of major roads up there. And you had an involved citizens committee. You held charrettes. You took citizens on walking tours of the area. And then when you unveiled your decision about what you were going to do, most of the attendees at the unveiling had not participated in any of those pre-activities, and they were angry about your conclusion. Well, that's what makes people disenchanted with government, because they don't like what you have decided, and yet they didn't participate.
Yeah.
So how do you make them make that connection?
And we thought we had done everything so right. We really did. Best efforts. I would change one thing. It wasn't a decision that we unveiled. It was the proposal from the consultants.
So they were angry about the proposal.
Yeah. And it was their opportunity to say, I don't see this, I see this, you know, or could we change this? But instead, we had a lot of vitriol at that meeting.
You know, last summer, Raleigh was the site every Monday of Moral Monday protests by citizens who came to Raleigh because they were disenchanted and angry about some decisions that the legislature had been undertaking. And they were greeted with being arrested, many of them, and ignored for the most part, although some people in the legislature had some disparaging things to say about these protesters. Now, that is democracy in action, isn't it?
It is.
Whether you agree with the Moral Monday people or not, they are citizens. They were making their displeasure known to their elected representatives. And if you're going to be disparaged and ignored, that raises the question, why am I wasting my time? Do elected officials really want to hear what I have to say? Or are they, by virtue of election, God?
Well, in the case of the two roads, we're going back to the drawing table. So no, absolutely we're not God. We listen to our citizens, and we're going back to the drawing table. And that meeting was at a local church, and we're going back to that local church next week to get more information from them to see what they want.
Absolutely. See, and I think that Maggie's point here is the point that we're seeing again and again. As we researched our book, Slow Democracy, we heard from communities all over who were realizing, as leaders, we need to re-envision the way we engage citizens and really revamp it to the modern age. It's not, sort of the industrial top-down, we create a plan and, once the plan is formulated, we invite citizens to comment. Now, there are many, many communities across the United States who are taking up whole new ways of engaging citizens. The first time you engage the citizens is when you have a small meeting of stakeholders to talk about how you're going to engage the citizens. So back it up way back to say, who are the stakeholders? Is it those of us at this table? Are we really thinking broadly enough? What kinds of demographic are we targeting, and is holding a 7 o'clock meeting going to be the way to do it, or right early on, should we be going to daycare centers and talking with parents? Should we be, talking to community groups, or, really thinking way outside the box and involvement early?
Is there a good time to have these meetings? Because, I quite often the city of Charlotte has meetings at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm thinking, people are going to fight the opposite traffic and come in here when everybody's trying to get out of town, and they're going to come in for a meeting, really, at 5 o'clock? I mean, they're still in the office at 5 o'clock. Really? 5 o'clock? Really?
And I would say that meetings oftentimes are really not even the paradigm we should be using anymore. We should be going to where people are. We should be going to their living rooms. Let them convene a little party in their neighborhood.
Huntersville Mayor Jill Swain is writing on our Facebook that she believes this is a chicken and egg issue. People want to be involved but need to see that money and partisan politics can be overcome. Wouldn't their best chance of overcoming party politics and money be at the local level?
Absolutely. In Salisbury, we're elected on a nonpartisan basis. I think people can probably infer what our parties are by our interests, but we run on a nonpartisan basis. So, we're sort of different, I think.
And I would think that conservatives who are generally against big government and therefore Washington would love the idea of slow democracy. And in some ways, I mean, that's how the Tea Party became so influential. It started at the local level, people agitating and electing their own people to office. How do liberals feel about this?
Well, think about how Occupy Wall Street started. Very similar.
But they weren't as successful as the Tea Party.
we say that. I hear you, and we say that. And yet, think about how often we use the term the 1% and the 99%. We've changed the way we think because of some of the machinations of that very dispersed group. Where are they now? We're not sure. And yet, we have changed because of that. So it's an interesting idea that the way that they organize themselves was not hierarchical, and yet still made changes.
I want to go back to this Industrial Revolution thing that you talked about in the first segment, because I never thought about this. And this is, I think, really fascinating, and I think it's right. You said essentially that when the Industrial Revolution, we came about as a nation of people who could. We were self-sufficient. We did it on our own, picked ourselves up by our bootstraps. If you had nothing and you made something of yourself, it's because you did it. No one gave it to you. You worked hard for it. Then along comes the Industrial Revolution, which required hierarchical structures because it was a machine. Not just the factory, but the whole system was a machine. Mm-hmm. And that led to greater centralization of everything, and it became a part of our DNA. It also required a bigger government in Washington to control all of this, and that became centralized. Well, now we're watching the democratization of everything. Democratization of the music industry, the democratization of information, the democratization of the television industry. We call the shots. We don't sit down at 8 o'clock and watch the Ed Sullivan Show on Sunday night. We tape it. If it was still on the air, we DVR it. We watch it when we want to watch it. So you're saying that government needs to be like that too in the information age. We need to get away from centralization and become involved in our local areas. And I would imagine that this information economy that we live in lends itself to that.
Absolutely. That's a great characterization of what's happening. And I think that one of the things that's so heartening about seeing this happen is that there's been a lot of new research now that shows that what happens to us as individuals if we do get involved personally. There's some great research, for example, on jury duty, which is something that we can study. But we see it again and again in other kinds of engagement at the local level, like Maggie, who decided to build a park. If we get involved in, even for example, in juries to deliberate and make empowered decisions, it often then goes on to increase voting rates. So I become a person who votes more often. It often increases volunteerism. Many people follow the news more after they've been involved in something like this. And it really strengthens our so you talked about a chicken and egg. This is sort of an upward virtuous spiral.
You mentioned the 1% of these phrases that have come out of the Occupy Wall Street movement. There's another phrase that's come out of the other side, and that is take our country back. We need to take our country back. Are they advocating for slow democracy? Is that what they're talking about? Mm-hmm. We want it the way it was, and the only way to make that happen, I guess, is for them to get involved.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I do think that, you know, sometimes we hear a cry like take our country back, and it almost sounds like a war cry, and we're going to have to take sides. You know, mm-hmm. one side wants the country to go this way, the other side wants the country to go that way. But I think that the data shows actually is that if all of us decided to take our country back and we worked together, we would be finding solutions that would keep us less polarized rather than more so.
There are a lot of myths that have been created about government, and you bring them up in your book, and maybe they stem from the fact that few people are truly involved as active participants in all of this, and with diminished civics education in the schools, a lot of people don't even understand how government really works. And you pop some of these myths in your book. One of them is that there's a belief that democracy is about fighting and about winning. It isn't?
Well, I'm sure that sometimes there's fighting and sometimes there's winning and losing. But when you think about what democracy was created for, I mean, we created wars to fight and win. We created democracy so that we didn't have to have wars. We created democracy so that we could talk through our problems and come up with a solution that works for both sides so that we don't have to fight. So it's a very interesting, you know, I think some of us are afraid of voicing our opinion because it might create conflict. Well, a verbal conflict is a wonderful thing because it's something that we can use so that we don't fight.
But when we talk about politics in this, you can go to a pub in England and they talk about politics and they leave friends. I mean, they may be on opposite sides of the issue and they can argue and slam their beer mugs down, but they leave friends. Here, we don't seem to be able to do that anymore. You're not like me, so I'm not going to have anything to do with you.
Well, I'm very optimistic. We have two young men in our youth council who claim to be cousins. I think that might not physically be so. One is an avid Republican and the other is an avid Democrat. Now, they're 16 and 17 years old, and they fight and fuss and argue about politics and then clap their arms around each other's shoulder and walk out. They started a debate team at our local high school because they feel that the kids of their generation don't know how to listen or to solve problems amicably.
Let's talk about that because we have this situation here, and we've become highly polarized. We have media that caters to that. We have Fox News on one side, MSNBC on the other side, and brain scientists are now telling us that we tend to shut out information that doesn't conform with what we already believe. So given that democracy is a deliberative process, an exchange of ideas has to reach an ultimate conclusion. How do you reach a conclusion if nobody wants to listen or can listen to what the other side of the argument is?
And I'm reading another book now. Sorry, Susan. I don't want to sound disloyal, but I'm reading Solving Tough Problems by Adam Kahane. And I was reading the preface last night, and it said, no problem can be solved if we won't listen. And going back to your point about our politicians' God, I would suggest that when you're getting ready to vote, the most important thing you can look at is, does this person listen? You know, in the forums or invite them to coffee. Are they talking all the time or are they truly listening? Because you want someone who's deliberative and who can listen and sometimes change his mind.
Susan.
Well, absolutely. And the brain science that you mentioned is there are some great examples of that in our book. It on the one hand, is disheartening. And on the other hand, the whole idea of slowing down is exactly the brain opening, you know, remove the Teflon metaphor that we're talking about. There's a great example of something called Living Room Conversations. If you Google Living Room Conversations, it's a new organization that was co-founded by Joan Blades, who is also the co-founder of MoveOn.org, so a very politically active woman, liberal. The point of Living Room Conversations is to bring together liberals and conservatives. So there's a whole process where you bring together six people in your living room of two different political viewpoints. She actually did one of these with Mark Meckler, who is the co-founder of the Tea Party Patriots. And using this process, they found tremendous amount of common ground.
Well, is it easier perhaps to – I mean, if you're an avid fan of Fox News and you happen to stumble on MSNBC, you may completely dismiss everything that's being said. And vice versa. If you're an MSNBC person and you happen to stumble on Fox News, you may just go and turn them off. But if you're sitting opposite somebody live and you're looking in their eyes, is there more of a propensity to listen to the other side? And even consider the other side.
Yeah, absolutely.
There absolutely is, which is, I think, one of the reasons to bring some of these conversations to the local level.
And wouldn't you agree, Mike, people are listening to Fox News or MSNBC not so much to learn the news, but to be affirmed in their party-held beliefs.
I have 2 minutes left, and I want to get to another myth in this book that you pop, that problems are becoming too complex for citizens to understand. And granted, there are so many very complex issues that people in government have to consider at all levels. It takes time to understand those. Do citizens who don't have the time to come to meetings have the time to read through all the stuff that you guys have to read through to understand what to do?
What do you think, Maggie? Is it useful to have just a plain old seat-of-the-pants response from a citizen?
Oh, absolutely. We couldn't function without it. Yeah. And that's why I'm reaching out to you, is so that we can get more plain old seat of the pants citizens to come into our meetings. That's the whole goal.
You close your book with 20 slow democracy rules that I will not have time to go through any of them, except I want to go through the one that I think is really interesting. Require a democratic impact statement when you are considering doing something. And that requires 30 seconds of explanation, because that's all you got.
Well, you know, we think about environmental impact statements, but what will the impact of our decision-making process be on our democracy? Are we going to, through this process, be a model and invite people into future discussions?
Fascinating book. It's called Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back Home, by Susan Clark, our guest today from Vermont, who will be in town shortly, and Maggie Blackwell, Mayor Pro Tem of the City of Salisbury. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.